And now, please help me welcome our main speaker for this morning, Bob D. from Las Vegas, Nevada, on the topic of ending loneliness using the 12 traditions.
It's a dumb topic, I'll tell you. Blame Kent. I'm Bob Darrell, and I am an alcoholic. And I'm a member of the Connect the Dots group in Las Vegas. And if you would ever go to that group, the other people there know that that's my home group by my actions. And that's very important. If you have a, if you tell people you have a home group and the people there don't know it's your home group, it's not. I have a sponsor, and he knows he's my sponsor by my actions. And if you have a sponsor that doesn't, it's not sure if they're your sponsor, they're not. And I have a sobriety date, which is October 31st, 1978, a day in my life that felt like the worst day of my life. And if you would have told me on that day that I would spend the next 38 years celebrating that day every year, I would have thought you were crazy. And it is exemplary of this thing that I don't know. And in 1978, when I got sober, I finally was, as the book says, we're beaten into a state of reasonableness. And I was always the I know guy. I'd worked in therapy. I read a lot. I was a smart guy. I was the I know guy. And in 1978, I only knew one thing for sure. I don't know. And that saved my life. It brought me into Alcoholics Anonymous where I could hear you. And I was thinking about this. I have my ego, even though I don't most of the time even recognize that it's there, it's so strong within me that it creates a resistance to anything that threatens its control, right? And it's an unconscious resistance. And I experienced that with AA. I sitting as a guy that was a perpetual newcomer for several years, in and out, I would sit there as my head would pick you apart. Because there's something in me that doesn't want, that resists what you have. Right? It doesn't want to get better. It doesn't want to lose its control. And then even after failing and just horrible, horrible relapses, I was step resistant. I'm not alone in this. Do you ever notice how you'll go to what the great lengths you'll go to rather than write your fourth step? Right? I'll wash my car. Yeah. I will tell my sponsor, you writing anything? I've been doubling up on my meetings, you know, I mean, because that's good. I want to throw something that looks good at the vacancy, right? And so, like, maybe I'll get credit for that. That's like going to the gym, killing yourself for 2 hours, and then coming, leaving and eating a whole cheesecake. I mean, one good action doesn't negate another, you know, it doesn't work that way. So I was very step resistant. And the pain of untreated alcoholism in a prolonged period of abstinence drove me to my knees in Alcoholics Anonymous, and where all of a sudden I got to this place where I'm going to have to do this. I know I've done two BS inventories, but I'm going to have to do what it says in the book because I got to do something here because I ain't right. And I don't know how long I can weather my not rightness in abstinence before picking up a drink will start seeming like a good idea. And so I was driven by my alcoholism. But well into sobriety, a long time into sobriety, decades, I was personally tradition resistant. Now, in the beginning, it was very adamant. In the beginning, it was just like I was the guy. If I went to a 12 by 12 12 and 12 study group, and they were on a tradition, I would all of a sudden realize I was needed at a different meeting across town. You know, because I don't want to. It just they were squirmy to me. I don't even like. I don't hear that. That's just boring. Boring. And then, you know, I got my first sponsor was a past delegate. He was a doer. Man, he was a doer. I met him because he brought meetings into the detox I was in twice a week. Sponsored a lot of guys, very service oriented. He didn't come from a big book consciousness. In the 70s and even up into the early 80s, the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous was big book conscious barren. I was a member of a home group that was a big book group. We'd read the big book and then people would tell their story. They'd read the big book, talk about their day. But nobody really had that laser-like focus that developed after Joe and Charlie on the big book that we developed. And so I didn't come from an era of big book consciousness. I came from an era where the people, the real solid members of AA, they were really big into amends. And they meant pay everybody back. I mean, I remember having a conversation with my sponsor about a drug dealer I owed money to. And I said, you know, I don't have to pay him. He's a drug dealer. He said, you owe him money? Yeah, we have to pay him. I mean, there was no compromise. And he was there was no compromise on service, right? They would not stand up against my justifications and rationalizations. They were very principled people. And they wanted me to do service and 12-step work, and it saved my life. And I ended up a GSR by default at about a year sober. I was a co-GSR, and the GSR got drunk. And I ended up a year sober as a GSR, and I went to my first assembly, and it got something inside me going. And when I was a couple years sober, I got tasked by my service sponsor, who at that time was a delegate and later one of the legendary trustee, Ruth. And Ruth tasked me with doing 2 hours every Sunday afternoon, a 12 concepts and service manual study group, which is a crowd pleaser. Yeah. Oh, I'd go in there to be a couple browbeaten newcomers in there, you know, new GSRs, two or three of them I'd sponsor, and the other two, they don't know why they're there, you know, right? But I did that for 2 years, and it's funny how stuff percolates into your unconscious, your subconscious, like, and then all of a sudden, 20 years later, it comes back because that's when you need it. I think God works like that, doesn't he? It's a funny thing. I've had things out of, for years ago, I've never thought about, and then all of a sudden I'm in a situation in my life and this great reality deep down within me sort of percolates something out. And all of it's like, it becomes you. The things that I did it, but I didn't really think it was useful become useful. A lot of things have been that way in my life. And you know, I started to honor the 12 traditions when I was in general service. I went to a lot of tradition workshops, area, district, a lot of stuff like that. But I got to tell you, if you're an egomaniac with an inferiority complex like mine, it's like I don't initially gravitate to this stuff because I'm a good soul. I gravitate it because I see opportunity in learning about the traditions to go to meetings and lord it over the deficient ones, right? I'm embarrassed to tell you that there was a period of time when I was armed with knowledge of the traditions and the service manual. I would go to meetings hopefully looking for tradition breaks. Right? So I could rise to the occasion and feel that smug superiority. And isn't it? I think it's bizarre that my alcoholic ego would take principles that are designed to connect me to life and God's kids and use them to separate me from life and God's kids. It's an ironic, there's no end to my ego's deviousness and its continual squirming for spotlight, prestige, all of it. And so I'm not aware of it, but it's happening. It's funny, in hindsight, I get a better view of me in hindsight than I ever had in the moment. I think maybe that's a blessing from God. Maybe there were times when I was so selfish and self-centered, if I'd have seen it in the moment, I'd have killed myself. I don't know. I don't know. Maybe it's a blessing. Who knows? And well, I was sober a long time. And Alcoholics Anonymous, and doing a lot of step work, taking a lot of guys through the steps, hearing a lot of inventories. And I've always, since day one, had service commitments here. I still have several a week. But AA, do you know your name is on this clock? But AA started to pale. It started to pale. It started to pale, and I started, you know, those subtle little feelings, like where you're all the things that you one time lit you up that you're doing AA, now you're making yourself do them, right? Having feelings in meetings like I don't fit, but I don't recognize it as that, because internally for me, it doesn't look like I don't fit. It looks like I've outgrown all of you and you're stupid, right? Do you know what I'm saying? Right, I can't even admit to myself that I have those squirmy little pathetic feelings. You know, when I go to my sponsor, I just feel lonely. You know, I don't say that, right? I'm lonely because you're stupid and I'm the only one here that gets this. You know, that kind of thing. And I found myself, and this has happened to me a couple times in my sobriety. Literally, I never left AA, and I never left my stopped doing service. I never have done that, and that's probably saved my life, because it's kept me tethered here long enough and solid enough for God to do His magic here through the group conscience. I'd get toward emotionally and experientially, I'd get to the edge of AA, looking in, never left. But I did that. I'm moving towards the edge, one judgment at a time, right? And I guess God has restored me to some small level of sanity, because there's something that's occurred in my sobriety that was never true for me before. Not only have I been able to learn occasionally from my own painful experience, I've watched you and learned from yours. And I've watched people leave AA, and they leave it one judgment at a time. One compromised action at a time, and they don't know they're leaving, right? That's the deviousness of this alcoholic ego that I have. It's out to kill me, but it doesn't manifest that way inside me. And there's a paragraph from step four in the 12 steps and 12 traditions that I just stumbled across it, and it was just me. And this is me with a lot of years of sobriety. And it says, it is from our twisted relations with family, friends, and society at large that many of us have suffered the most. We have been especially stupid and stubborn about them. The primary fact that we fail to recognize is our total inability to form a true partnership with another human being. Our ego mania digs two disastrous pitfalls. Either I insist upon dominating the people I know, and it's for their best interest, or I depend upon them far too much. If I lean too heavily on people, they will sooner or later fail me and disappoint me. It's like everybody's just, you know what, the human race is a funny place. I have high hopes for all of you individually, and you always let me down, right? they will. If we lean too heavily on people, they will sooner or later fail us, for they are human too and cannot possibly meet our incessant demands. In this way, our insecurity grows and festers. When we habitually try to manipulate others to our own willful desires, they revolt and resist us heavily. Then we develop hurt feelings, a sense of persecution. You know that feeling that they're just out to get me because I know the truth, right? That sense of persecution and a desire to retaliate. As we redouble our efforts at control and continue to fail, our suffering becomes acute and constant. We have not once sought to be one in a family, to be a friend among friends, to be a worker among workers, to be a useful member of society. Always I've tried to struggle to the top of the heap or to hide underneath it. This self-centered behavior blocked a partnership relation with any of those about us. Of true brotherhood, I had small comprehension. I remember reading that and almost being sick to my stomach because it was true. And this is not because I'm a newcomer. This is how deviously and unconsciously my ego squirmed back into position again. And at one time, I think I really was surrendered for a short period of time. And then as Harry Thiebaud talks about this amazing recuperative powers of the alcoholic ego. And there came a point, I traveled with Joe and Charlie for a number of years and did the traditions with them, did the big book, did a bunch of stuff. And somewhere in there, I think it was when I started to wake up to the 12 traditions and what they would mean for personal application. As if, what if we didn't have the steps? And the only thing I had to change and save my life was the spiritual principles of the 12 traditions. What would that look like? What would it look like if truly the common welfare, how you're doing and what you, if everybody else came first and I was last, if I really position myself through my actions and my approach to life, that thing they talk about in the prayer of St. Francis, that self-forgetting, what would that look like? Wouldn't look like Bob. What would that look like? This idea that my personal recovery, and that's the hook, because Bill's brilliant. He's got to give you, he knows how self-centered we are. So he's got to give you a little self-interest to get you to do things that you're resistant to. So my personal recovery depends upon AA unity. In other words, I have to be one with you and one with here in order to survive Bob. And unity has always unconsciously been a big piece of business with me. And I didn't know it. I drank alcohol for unity. I drank alcohol because I'm the lonely guy that can't talk to people. I can't fit. I can't talk to girls. I can't make good friendships. I don't know how to fit. And I could go into a bar and I'd just be so lonely because I'd go in there sober and four drinks in. Oh, these are my best lifelong friends. I mean, you know, eight drinks in, I'm saying things like, I love you, bro. You know, I mean, just feel that connectedness. And when you have suffered the pangs of anxious apartness that Wilson talks about, when you suffered the loneliness of alcoholism and you're unconscious of it, yet you suffer from it, my abstinence would always be, I loved the feeling of connection that I got when I drank. This is not an AA sentiment necessarily, but I'll tell you the truth. If alcohol would have continued to do that for me, I would have never got sober. I'd have been willing to pay the price. I'd be willing to spend 6 months out of every year in jail if I could get high like I got high when I was 18, right? because I didn't think that AA could do that for me. I thought AA was just going to get me to quit drinking. Wow, whoopee. And so I didn't understand how important unity is here. There comes a time, I think, in some of us where we realize that the most important thing we have in our life, it's more important than your husband or wife. It's more important than your kids. It's more important than your house, your job. It's your seat in Alcoholics Anonymous. That your chair here is the most important thing you have. Because without that, you're going to lose everything else anyway, right? Now, if you're a problem drinker, that may not be true. If you're a hard problem drinker, the person who drinks horrifically and dangerously and destroys their life, but when they get sober, they're good. Then that might not apply. But I am the chronic alcoholic. I don't just have an abnormal reaction to alcohol. I have an abnormal reaction to abstinence. And it's your fault somehow. And I can't always figure that out, but it always seems to be your fault. You know, our common welfare should come first. My personal recovery, I have to be connected here. And have to do, that means, that you know what that means sometimes? That means sometimes I'll have to make amends to people when I didn't even do anything. But they think I did. And Sandy used to say, the person with the most tools gets to do the work. Right? So I've had many, many conversations with people in AA where I watch them and they act like I've hurt them. Now, I don't know what I did. But I also understand that I am very capable of stepping on people's toes and not realizing it. Because I just got me right here and I don't even know I'm stepping on your toes. I'm just trying to get to the next thing that's important to Bob. And I don't even know it. So I've gone up to people and I say, listen, I want you to know something. I've always liked you. I love you. But I have a feeling like I did something. Maybe I don't unconsciously that stepped on your toes. And if that's the case, please tell me what it is, man. I don't want to be like this with you. Tell me what it is. I'd like to make it right. And because nothing's more important than being one with here. Because if you left unchecked, what happens is I'm not going to be around him. I'm not going to be around him. He's an idiot too. I'm not going to be around him. And I resent by, if I just think you don't like me, I'm going to not like you first. And not only am I going to resent you, I'll resent by default everyone who you know and likes you. Which, I'm telling you something, Alcoholics Anonymous can become a lonely business like that. So nothing's more important than my chair here. You know, and that's not just true. That's true in everything, in every area of my life. It's true in all my friendships, interactions with people. It's true in my business. I ran my company for a lot of years on the 12 traditions. The non-alcoholic people who worked for me didn't know they were the 12 traditions. It's funny, we resist these principles. Normal people go, oh yeah, that's a good idea. No, really, they do. I mean, it's like, I had to blunge in my sponsees with a big book for weeks to get them to go to, just to even, no, they just, oh, unity, yes, that's good. Group conscience. Oh, nice. That's great. That's very nice of you to think of that. Huh? Well, I'm telling you. You know, not only for my group purpose, but for my personal purpose. There is an ultimate authority here. I mean, it's the turning point. It's the crux of AA. It's where we begin to live our life on a different basis. It's a third step prayer. It's the intention of surrender, even though we may not, that just saying the prayer doesn't surrender you. It's the intention of surrender. I'm on a different basis now. The basis of trusting and relying upon God. And there is this ultimate authority. The tradition says, expresses himself in our group conscience. I think there's a covenant in Alcoholics Anonymous that when two or more of us come together for the purpose of recovery, God's in the midst. And I think that's true on a one-on-one individual, one alcoholic talking to another. I think it's true with my sponsor. It's been true with the people I sponsor. How many people in here sponsor people? All right, I'm preaching to the choir here. You guys know this. If you sponsor people, you know that God will, he'll do stuff in you. You'll be with someone who's struggling and suffering, and the truth is you have nothing to give them. And it's a funny dynamic. It's like a portal opens up inside of me, and stuff comes out that I don't even... I've had this experience where I catch myself saying something to a guy, and it's blowing my mind what I'm saying to the guy, right? It's like, I should write this down. I think I'm going to need this, right? You know, we don't just keep this thing by giving it away. I think sometimes we get this thing by giving it away. And I tell you, you know, they made the announcement about the cell phones. And Carl Jung talked about the collective unconscious. And I think that, to me, that I think what he's talking about is the same thing it talks about in the book, The Great Reality, the same thing they talk about in tradition number two, the way God will express himself. And God talks to us continually in meetings, but you got to show up where God, in the venues where God speaks the loudest. And hundreds of times he's talked to me in AA meetings, hundreds of times. Where I'm sitting there and I'm not doing well, or I got some unresolved stuff in my life, or an unmade amends, or something going on, and there'll be some stranger there, and he's just at the moment when I can hear it starts talking about what's going on with me. And the reason that in my home group and a lot of groups that I have a lot of respect for in Alcoholics Anonymous, we discourage anything that's a distraction in the meeting, like your cell phones. And I know I learned this the hard way by having my cell phone on in a meeting, and sometimes it's an innocent thing you forget. But what happens when it goes off? There could be people sitting around you that God's talking to through the people that are sharing the meeting, and now there's like a minute and a half of blank spot in the meeting because of the cell phone. Well, that's not that bad. Here's what's really bad. It's when it's your cell phone and it goes off. Now you don't hear anything the rest of the meeting because everyone who turned and glared at you when your cell phone off, you're going to have a conversation in your head with them for the rest of the meeting. Right? And besides, I know you hope this, but trust me. Your ex is not going to come to their senses and be properly ashamed of themselves during the meeting. It's not going to happen. God doesn't work that way. Who's going to call you? Is it telemarketer? Who's going to call you? Oh, God. So I don't want to do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous. I try to sit quietly. Sometimes if I drink a lot of tea or stuff, sometimes I got to get... I hate it. I hate to do this. Sometimes I have to get up and go to the bathroom. Beyond my control, it's the lesser of two evils of sitting there and, yeah, no, it would be bad. But I don't like to do that because I try to be like a mouse when I do it, be small and not disruptive, because if I have to do that, because I want you to be able to hear what God's talking to you here, for God's sakes. Open your ears, listen. Be present here. That's why texting is such a horrific thing. We make an announcement in my home group. No cell phones, no texting. Because not only are you not hearing God when you're texting or hearing anything else, you're consumed up in your head with you and the phone, but the people next to you, the light's on, and that's why they tell you in movie theaters, don't have it on. Because it's a distraction, right? Now, you can choose to come here and not hear anything. You can choose to come here and think we're all full of crap. You can choose to not do none of this. That is your right. But don't interfere with someone else who's trying to struggle towards the light Don't get between them and the light. Don't do that. You know, you could be, you just never know. Billy said something last night I really liked. I too have been, and I've thought this for a long time. I wished we would have, you know, I wish Wilson would have held his ground on the long form. But you know, he couldn't get, he there's letters in our archive. He couldn't get people. He couldn't get groups. They didn't even want to read them because they're long. I mean, my old home group, we used to read them. You watch the newcomers who have the attention span of a gnat, you know, sitting there. And it's just like, oh, make it stop. Let's get back to the important stuff that has to do with me. You know, it's right. It's like, and I get it. I'm that way. I'm wired like that. I get it. I don't condemn people for being that way. But I understand. I understand Wilson's frustration. So when Earl Treat, and I got this information just recently from Gail, when Earl Treat wrote the short form, I always knew it wasn't Wilson. I just didn't know who until Gail told me. And Dr. Bob had sort of sponsored Earl, I guess, from a guy from Chicago. And the pressure was on Wilson, and A is falling apart. He conceded to adopt those, and that's the one. Most members of AA don't even know the long form exists. But in the third tradition, the long form really nails it for me. And I think that the adaptation of the short form changed Alcoholics Anonymous. And I can look at this from both sides of the street. It's brought a lot of people into AA, and it's helped them and enriched their lives. But it's also brought a lot of people into Alcoholics Anonymous who just have a desire not to drink, and they don't suffer from alcoholism. So every positive thing that may have come about as a result of it, I think there's an equal, if not greater, negative thing that's happened to us as a result of it. See, I am not an everyday member of AA because I have a desire not to drink. I'll tell you, that isn't even a piece of business in my life. I everything that talks about in step 10 has happened for me. I've been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected from alcohol. And through little effort on my part, except I just, if you treat your alcoholism, your drinking takes care of itself, right? So I'm not an everyday member of Alcoholics Anonymous because I have a desire not to drink. I mean, I do if I stop and think about it. Oh, yeah, I don't want to know. I love my sobriety, yeah. But I am an everyday member of Alcoholics Anonymous because I suffer from alcoholism in sobriety, in those feelings that are intermittent for me of restless, irritable, discontent, the feelings of anxious apartness and separation, the depression that so many of us, from Bill Wilson on, have been plagued with, all of that. And so I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, I work these steps, I sponsor guys, I do service here, I do all of this because I suffer from alcoholism. I don't do it because I'm a good guy. I don't do it so people walk around and say, I touched the hem of his garment. I mean, I don't do that. I do it because I suffer, because I have a horrid, horrid case of alcoholism. I am a high-maintenance alcoholic. Oh, my God. I am a I wish there's not everybody in AA is like me. There are people that can just, they're fine. They go to one meeting a week, and when they're really want to amp up their spirituality, they might go to two. They might even say hi to a newcomer once in a while. I mean, you know, they've made every amends that was coming at them and they couldn't duck. But they're fine. I used to resent those people. I remember going to my sponsor and just, I was angry. Because I'm at meetings, I'm doing all this service, I'm doing all this crap, I'm paying they want me to pay everybody back. And I'm going to my sponsor and I'm complaining. You know, and he just, and he said, you have to play the hand you're dealt, not the hand they're dealt. You got to find your alcoholism here, and I mean beyond the drinking. You got to find your alcoholism here. Beyond the drinking. and bring that to Alcoholics Anonymous, because that's what we're about. Alcoholics Anonymous is not designed to treat your drinking problem. That's a benefit from it. But we're really designed to treat your abstinence problem, to treat everything that happens to you that makes you subtly alone and depressed and separate in your abstinence. And that's what we do here. And we do it very effectively. It's a magical thing that happens here, the way God works through all this stuff. And so I'm an everyday member of Alcoholics Anonymous because of that. And this, I love what, God, I really liked Billy's talk last night. The thing about autonomy, the tradition of autonomy, the principle of autonomy, without an awakening and a consciousness of the other traditions and the welfare of others, is just, it's a wild card to be rebellious and crazy and self-serving. But autonomy gives us an amazing amount of freedom, but freedom without consciousness of responsibility is anarchy. It's destructive. And so and this is not true just of us. This is built into the consciousness of the human race. One of the great things God has given us, and sometimes the most horrid thing he's given us, is free will. Free will, we're the only creatures on the planet that have the ability to go against your very instincts and your very nature to the point of self-destruction. You'll never walk through a forest and see a deer smoking a crack pipe, right? And drinking a bottle of wine. It doesn't happen. Because, matter of fact, the deer's going to go, nah. But God's given us free will. We can actually choose, not only, we can choose to go against him to the point where we're killing people, we're hurting people, and even possibly kill ourselves. That we can actually go against that to that degree. And the same thing is true in Alcoholics Anonymous. There's no enforcement here of the 12 traditions. My sponsor says something funny. He said, wouldn't it be nice if we had AA police, right? You've broken the traditions. We're going to take you away to a re-education camp, But it doesn't happen. It's not happening here. We are granted a tremendous amount of freedom. But wake up. And that's, my sponsor has been brilliant with me to get me to look at every action I take and what does it speak to the newer people, right? What does it speak to the newer people? You want to text in a meeting? Great. You have the freedom to do that. But you only get one vote and it's your actions. What you're really saying, I think everybody should be doing this. Do you want everybody to do that? No, but my case is different. I understand the rules. I just secretly think I'm above them, or they don't apply to me. They apply to everybody else. Isn't it funny? I think the rules should apply to everyone except me. Like the handicapped parking thing. Oh, that's important. Handicapped people need easy access, but I'm only going to be a minute. Right? Above the rules. That's my alcoholic ego. I'm above the rules. And so we hope that this tremendous, tremendous freedom that we're given here, this autonomy, that you also develop a consciousness of others. There's a lot of things I don't do. I'm a selfish guy by nature. I'm a self-gratifying. I'm all of that. Everything we all are, I'm that. But there's a lot of things I do not do because I don't want to put that, I don't want to speak that to the newer people and give them the green light on that stuff. Right? I don't want to do it. You're more important than me. How did that happen? Man. Tradition number 5 has been crucial in my life. I don't know at what point in my innermost self I really got this, but when I did, it changed everything. that, you know, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous like all of us. My primary purpose is me and my feelings and my relief and what you think of me and my comfort and my finances and my sex and me. And to get a level, a small, tiny level of self-abandonment where my primary purpose is no longer me. And I'm given an alternate primary purpose. And that's to help God's kids, to help other alcoholics. That really is why I'm placed here on earth. That is why I've survived this fatal illness called alcoholism. It's not to have a big house and not to have money, not to have friends, it really has nothing to do with me. I am given a purpose that is greater than me. And I'll tell you something, when you claim that and you understand at a gut level that your life is not is not your own, that you've been saved from the abyss for one reason only, is to take all that pain, all that struggle, all those defects, all of that, and make it useful in God's hands, all of a sudden life makes sense. All of a sudden, there's a rightness about everything. When it was about me, nothing's right. Nothing's right. But when I claim my primary purpose, man, even the worst things about me, the things that were the deepest, darkest secrets become useful here in God's hands. And to claim, to start, rather than serving myself, to start to serve a principle and a set of principles and a purpose and ultimately a power and a people that I've made of greater importance than myself. I had a nun in Catholic school. She used to say something I thought was the stupidest thing I ever heard. She said, God first, other people second, me always last. I thought, nah. It's me first, me second, and just me. That's all it is. It's just me. I suffered a lot in Alcoholics Anonymous because I 19 years sober, I got into a depression because my primary purpose, unbeknownst to me, started being bled away by the abundance and the toys and the money and the prestige until I had become my primary purpose and I started getting depressed. A person wrapped up in themselves makes a very small package. No matter how good you get it out here, if it ain't no good in here, if you're not aligned with your purpose and God's will in your life, there's nothing. None of it means anything, truthfully. And so I that's where I really started to claim my primary purpose. I was like almost 20 years sober. Now I was taking the actions, but I'm in my innermost self. Not so much. And you know what? One of the great things about having a home group and a sponsor and sponsoring people is that you will take actions you don't feel like because you don't want to look bad. AA is one of the few places on the planet I know of that'll take my hyper concern with what you think of me and use it to make me better or to tether me here, right? I mean, I don't know any other place on the planet that'll do that. Wilson was brilliant when he talks about money, property, and prestige. If he could add one more thing in there that would divert you from your primary purpose, it's probably sex. And these are the things that, you know, I've shied away from a few people in Alcoholics Anonymous because they're prestige predators. I had a friend, and I found out that he gets every talk he's ever made, and he puts it on YouTube and sends it to recovery websites. I said, are you kidding me? He said, oh, no, my message is important. That's creepy to me, right? I mean, if selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of our trouble, isn't that like Self-promotion is like arming the Al-Qaeda, isn't it? I mean, or ISIS. I mean, it's don't feed the things in you that should be starved. And that, I'll tell you, I don't know about you guys, that's my natural tendency, is to feed the things that should be starved, and I will, unbeknownst to me, starve the things that should be fed. That's why I have a sponsor. That's why I sponsor guys. There's a lot of accountability in sponsoring people, because you wake up one day, they're the primary example of how to be an AA member. You're the primary example to them, how to be an AA member, how to live your life, and how to exist on spiritual principles. And let me tell you something. Your sponsees watch you more than you could ever imagine. They watch you. You know how you know that? Do some self-serving out-of-line crap and see how many of them join you within 2 weeks. All right, they watch you. Tradition 7, I'd be self-supporting. I thought, when I first got sober, I thought step one was get a job. I mean, it was, Jesus. I had a chance, I was a year sober and I'd been working as a counselor in treatment, which against my sponsor's wishes, you know, but I have enough ego is returned that I think I'm smarter than he is, you know. I think he's just jealous because I found a way to do 12-step work and get paid for it, and he never figured that out. That wasn't the case at all, and I lost that job. Thank God. God has done for me consistently what I couldn't do for myself. And I lost that job, and I was in a position to get $120 a week in unemployment. Now, back in the 70s, that's a fair, I could have lived on it. It wasn't nice, but I could have lived on it. He made me take a job where after taxes, I only made between $96 and $97 a week, and I had to work 40 hours for the $96. I could have got the $120 for free. And sometimes you just know, he doesn't know about arithmetic, does he? He just doesn't, you know. But he was so right because I'm a taker. I've been a taker all my life. I've been a user of people, a taker. I'm a me. I'm like the black hole of life. Just I'll suck everything I can out of life and out of you. And they want me to take the actions of a giver, and they don't even care if I feel like it. Just do it. And so I started becoming so they wouldn't let me take the free money. To this day, I look back, and sometimes I even look back to this day and go, but it was free money. That free money might have killed me. Would have done something to my sense of myself and my spirit for sure. And it's brilliant. I want to talk a little bit about Tradition 8, and I want to read it in the long form. I think it's very important. Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional. We define professionalism as the occupation of counseling alcoholics for fees or hire. We may employ alcoholics where they're going to perform those services for which we might otherwise have to engage non-alcoholics. But our usual AA 12-step work is never, never to be paid for. We hire a lot of people to do a lot of clerical administrative stuff. That's not 12-step work. That's right. If you go to GSO, you'll meet a whole bunch of people that work hard there to serve Alcoholics Anonymous, but they're not getting paid for 12-step work. I know central office managers that answer the phones, and if they take a call rather than refer it out and start working with the guy, they take themselves off the clock. They will not get paid for that time. That's right. And yet I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was a relapser from the early 70s until 78. From the time I was like 19 to I finally got sober. And one of the things that I didn't understand, I thought it was lame, but it impressed me, is nobody was making money here off of nobody. And I live in a world where everybody's got an angle, right? And nobody here's trying to charge me for nothing, no, nothing. And that impressed me. I think that altruism is the heart of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'll tell you, I get scared sometimes because there's more self-serving in Alcoholics Anonymous today than I think that's ever existed. I'm talking in the fellowship. Now, there's some argument is, well, they're not really AA. Yeah, but they present themselves as AA. And the new people don't know any difference. We got sober coaches now that charge rich people. They prey on rich, famous people and get huge amounts of money. I ran into a very, very famous guy in one of the treatment centers I take a meeting into every week. And when he found out that, when he marched in with all the new people, when he found out that it was an AA meeting, he stormed out because he'd had a recovery coach who got a lot of money from him. He got a house from him on the beach. He got a lot of stuff from, and then he got thrown under the bus. Now, he's an idiot newcomer. He doesn't know that that's not AA. He doesn't know. See, to him, he won't go to AA anymore because that's because of that, right? And I see a lot of that. There's people writing books to grandize themselves and promote themselves. There's members of AA that have their own websites where you can go on there and buy talks of them or their workbook, right? I mean, what the hell's happened to us here? This was the altruistic spiritual movement of all time at once. I mean, Billy Graham said it. He said he thought it was the greatest. He said this in early 80s, the greatest spiritual movement of the 20th century. Nobody's saying that about us today. And I know that there are pockets of principle in Alcoholics Anonymous. I believe my home group is for the most part. You can't control some of the newer people and the rim runners that go around the edge of groups, you know. But in the solid people in my home group are very principled and very into the traditions, and they try to be servants of AA. But that's, for every group like that, there's probably 20 where you go to the meeting and you don't even know if it's Alcoholics Anonymous or not. I heard one speaker talk for 10, 15 minutes about their addiction to chewing ice cubes. And it was at a detox. And I was just sitting there, and these new people are just, their eyes are glazing over. I don't know what that is about. Right? What are they doing there? Right? The traditions are being a primary purpose. It's being thrown under the bus. I love what the way Billy puts that. The importance of that and is that If we let other people into Alcoholics Anonymous and they don't have alcoholism, if they have alcoholism, you can have a whole bunch of other problems. We don't care. I don't care if you did crack or heroin or pills or you gambled or you watched porno till you ended up in the burn unit. We don't care. We don't care what you did. It's immaterial. It's immaterial. But you got to have alcoholism, because if you don't have alcoholism, here's the problem, is that we'll have a substantial percentage of our fellowship who can drink. And I'll tell you something that's scary. Some of them do, and they don't tell anybody. And they do, and they can get away with it because they don't have the allergy to alcohol. I had a horrific experience when I, right 2 weeks before I was 30 years sober, so this would have been almost 9 years ago, I was doing a workshop in Tucson, and we were doing it, the first part of it was on the doctor's opinion. And before I started, this woman with 30 years, she just showed me her 30-year chip. She came up, showed me her 30-year chip. It's an older gal. She's got a whole row of people that she sponsors in their first year or two sitting there, all these gals. And I was excited. I said, oh, great, you got 30. I said, you know, if I make it to the end of the month, I'll have that. And I started the workshop, and after the workshop, she comes up to me and does the weirdest thing I've ever seen or heard yet. She comes, she's making sure nobody can hear, and she says, I don't have that thing you're talking about. I said, what thing? I said, I don't have that allergy, that phenomenon of craving. Well, she's 30 years sober, I think. And I think, well, she just doesn't remember. Because you know how alcoholism, the craving hits you, it uses your own mind against you. You can't see it's a craving. You just know you need another drink. I mean, no. So, right. So I just said to her, I said, well, it's been 30 years since you've had a drink. You just can't see it that far back. And then she does this. It's so weird. She looks to the left, and then she looks to the right, and she whispers, well, actually, I have a drink once in a while. My face evidently falls because she starts backpedaling, going, but I don't get drunk. I don't get drunk. Really, I don't get drunk. I said, you took a 30-year chip. Did you feel bad taking it? Well, I don't get drunk. I just have a glass of wine once in a while. And we talked a little bit, and she came 30 years prior to Alcoholics Anonymous with her husband, who was an alcoholic. He sent her to Al-Anon. She did not like Al-Anon. But she liked Alcoholics Anonymous, because if you're an untreated Al-Anon, it's a room full of your drug of choice here, right? You know what I'm saying? Right. So she loved AA. She loved AA. Oh, so many people to help. Oh, you know, she loved AA. So we had this conversation, and she, I don't know if she did this, she agreed to change her sobriety date and go to Al-Anon. I don't know if she did or not. I've been down there many times since, and I haven't seen her, so maybe, I don't know. But I had this bad feeling in the pit of my stomach, and the bad feeling is all those new people she sponsored. You see, the first thing that I trust here is that you're like me. What would have happened to me if I would have been at a year sober, still on very shaky ground, if I would have found out that my sponsor never was an alcoholic and he drank, or he could drink anytime he wanted to with impunity, it would have rattled the very foundation I have here. There's a guy in a halfway house intermittently in Vegas. He can't get sober because he hates AA, because his sponsor returned to drinking after 5 years sober. And he drinks with impunity. He had a little bit of a coke problem, but he never had the allergy to alcohol. And now he doesn't trust anything about it. He thinks we're all phony. So alcoholics, the singleness of purpose here makes AA like a laser. You take a laser and you focus it tightly. You can cut a steel beam. There's so much power in that laser. And our singleness of purpose when it comes to the problem, and our singleness of purpose when it comes to the solution, make Alcoholics Anonymous like a laser. But if you spread that beam out of over a wide enough surface, I'll tell you, get to a point where you can't even read a newspaper by it. So Alcoholics Anonymous is the only thing that's ever happened in the course of human events that's done for me and for us, I believe, what AA has done for us. I would hate to be like one of those guys that wondered what happened to the Washingtonians, right? My daughter is not an alcoholic, thank God. But in my family, alcoholism hopscotches. It's almost like every other generation. So now my daughter's in a very serious relationship. They're talking a little bit about marriage, and it means I could be a granddad, and I'm telling you, I will be very good at that. I'll load her up, load the kids up with sugar and return them to their mom. But here's my fear. Chances are, genetically, there's a high probability that my grandkids, who I know I'm going to love, could have alcoholism. And if I hope that Alcoholics Anonymous, as I found it here, this altruistic movement of love and service, this nudging each other into self-forgetting and serving.